Welcome back to the latest episode of the Elaborate Podcast. This is another special one. We have a special guest joining us in the studio today. Warren, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule and joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
So can you just tell us who you are? Of course, we know who you are, but for our dear listeners...
Of course.
Yeah?
Yeah, my name is Warren Batt. I am from a little place called Manchester in England, and I've been living in Madrid now for about 20 years. Well, just gone 20 years, actually. What can I tell you? I originally came to Barcelona. I did a year up in Barcelona, then moved to Madrid, did 4 or 5 years down here. Then I moved to Costa Rica, was over in Costa Rica for a couple of years. But I've been back in Spain since 2006. So okay. I'm not a full Madrileño, but I'm almost one.
You came over here. Were you doing some ESL teaching in your early days over here?
No. I am one of the lucky few who has never been an English teacher. I would be a terrible English teacher because I have no patience.
What's your secret? We need to find out because we're trying to escape.
Well, I don't know. The secret is not necessarily that much of a secret. I had a career in finance when I originally came over.
Okay.
So I was working for various banks in the UK, and I got offered a position in the financial sector over here, working as a financial advisor.
Okay.
So that's what brought me over originally, and then the job that I had there in Barcelona transferred me to Madrid after a year, and then I bounced around a couple of different companies and ended up in investments. And then that company offered me the position over in Costa Rica to open a new office for them over there. So I persuaded my wife that was the best thing for us to do, and never quite heard the end of that. And so from 2004 to 2006, we were over there. But after, you know, probably a good 8 or 9 years in that industry, I'd finally just grown sick of it. It's not the nicest industry to work in, to be honest. The money's very good, but really you're helping rich people get richer and poor people get poorer.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, had a moment where I was, okay, I need to do something with my life that matters a little bit more. So we made the rather ludicrous decision to resign without anything planned from that job. And, you know, we gave them 3 or 4 months notice and just said, no, we're leaving. We're going back to Spain.
Wow. That's a fantastic reason for leaving a job with convictions and principles.
Yeah.
And did it feel a mixture of excitement and fear of the unknown of the future?
Certainly excitement. Unfortunately for my wife, I'm a bit of a risk taker, so there wasn't too much fear. Because I arrogantly assumed, because I had such a good career in Costa Rica and in previously, that I would be able to get something wonderful as soon as I came here. But that wasn't actually my experience. I had a really tough time when I first came back. And it was a kind of a journey of the first year or two of personal discovery. I'm a person of faith, and so I had some quite interesting moments during those 2 years where I realized that a lot of my identity had been built on career and how much money's in the bank and who people think you are. And I had to arrive at a place where I was independent from that before I could then go out back into the working world and say, okay, I want to do something now that really matters, not that's just got a good name or a good salary or anything like that.
Okay.
So.
And speaking of finding, I guess, meaning, you know, and doing something that is rewarding,
right.
Have you been following the elections that we've had in Madrid recently? I mean, this past weekend.
A little bit, yes.
And in the nationals, we've seen a swing to the left, and in the locals, a swing to the right. Carmena has lost her position as mayor, for example.
Right.
And we won't get too bogged down in the politics, of course, but how do you see the discourse, the debate between people? Do you think that these swings indicate, in their own way, a search for meaning? Are there political footballs that are just being kicked around? Or what is your kind of perspective on this?
I mean, I'm certainly not an expert, but I think we're in a very delicate time in history, in that people are so polarized in every position. You're either 100% right or you're 100% wrong.
Yeah.
The chance to discuss things and debate and arrive at consensus, we seem to have lost that ability. And I think a lot of it, funnily enough, is social media that's driven us there.
Yeah.
Because we're in the meme generation, where if you can't put it in, you know, 140 characters, it can't be true.
And there's two things we can touch on throughout the interview as well. It's about social media, because you are, as we will discuss, involved with Serve the City, which I imagine social media is something that is very important in getting the message out there. I remember when I was involved in terms of just volunteering for things, the photographs would be uploaded, there'd be events afterwards for the volunteers, that would all be through social media as well. And going forward, it must be quite tricky learning how to navigate this social media world where everything's so polarized. And even, I think as well, messages of volunteering have gotten lost in big issues that are dominating our conversation more and more, and people aren't really talking about volunteering so much. They're talking about maybe refugees or immigration or the Me Too movement. Those are the things that dominate social media. So apart from trying to find space to get your voice heard, even if you can get your voice heard, navigating the polarization must be a nightmare, I think, no?
Well, I think they're a nightmare if you pay too much attention to it.
Yeah.
I think the world moves in streams of fashion, okay? So 10 years ago, the fashion was stop cutting down the trees. We're using too much paper, let's go paperless. Now it's, hang on a minute, the plastic's far worse. Let's stop using plastic. So what's the alternative? We go back to paper.
Okay.
And so, you know, there's paper bags everywhere and we're not really concerned about that anymore. And it's the same with these movements. The refugee movement is still a huge issue, but a couple of years ago it was the fashion, you know, and everyone wanted to talk about it and everyone wanted to be involved in it, but it goes out of the news cycle, something else comes up, and those people are forgotten again. So I think that the reality is you can do what you do, and if you're passionate about what you do, you'll spread that passion to other people. And I wonder sometimes if we're trying to influence too many people. You know, the reality is that we're bombarded by so many messages every day. I think we're far better served by saying, look, I've been put in an environment where there's a small group of people around me, and those are the people I should be really hoping that I can have influence on.
Okay.
And if those people are strongly enough influenced, they'll influence a few people too. So I actually use social media very little. We had someone employed at Serve the City who did all the social media, because I just find it, it's just a never-ending cycle that you can't get ahead of. You know, you can never get ahead of it.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked as a blogger as well, where social media was always the job that, part of my job I hated the most, because it's very draining. There's no real point to it. And it's just, as you said, it's just kind of noise and nonsense. And you mentioned two interesting things there. And so we'll touch on Serve the City, but you mentioned just focusing on the people that are around us. Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New Worlds, has a quote where the only part of the universe we can really improve is ourselves, and I guess by an extension as well, those in our immediate surroundings as well. And you mentioned finding meaning as well, and that's also something that's very, I think, popular at the moment. Russell Brand has a podcast where he talks about that. Blind Boy in Ireland has a podcast that talks about that as well. So and they both quote it independently, Marcus Aurelius, about being the harbor wall, that even though the tide kind of goes in and out and up and down, you are fixed and secure and kind of centered, I guess, as well. In your search, you mentioned for a couple of years you're searching for, I guess, that anchor. Were there any kind of resources that you used, or writers or thoughts that you kind of pulled from?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, my background is I come from a place of faith, so I class myself as a follower of Jesus, not as a Christian, funnily enough, but perhaps that's another topic for another time.
Come back next week.
But yeah, what I mean by that is that my understanding is based on who I'm, what I believe created to be.
Okay.
And that's not influenced by the job I do or the bank balance I've got or what other people think of you. And that's a very difficult thing to step back from, you know, because we're so influenced by what people think of us. So I read extensively, and funnily enough, for me, the key to centering myself was actually humility, understanding what real humility is. Because our society now is overwhelmed by people like Trump, who are extremely prideful, and they're pushing a message about how great they are all the time. And it seems like you just can't admit to any weakness. But again, that's it's kind of like social media. There's no end to that. There's no end to that. And eventually, I feel like the stress of that must kill people.
Yeah.
But admitting, you know what, I'm just doing the best I can do here. And I don't have all the answers. I know a few things, but I'm hoping that I'm going to meet other people that have answers to questions that I need. And just treating every individual with respect.
Okay.
Because they have an equal worth to you, whether they're a person on the street or whether they're the board director of a big company, they're just the same. Mm. And it took me a long time to get my head around that, to truly, okay, understand what I'm saying in my mind, but then accept it in my heart and to actually say, okay, I can walk forward like that now.
Mm-hmm.
So I read extensively on the topic of humility and in fact ended up writing a book on humility.
Wow. and you can plug that now as well, of course.
Yeah, I know, yeah. There's nothing more humble than plugging a book on humility.
But no, of course. Is it on Amazon?
Yeah, it's on Amazon.
What's it called?
It's called Humility, the Impossible Virtue.
Wow, okay. Yeah. That sounds like an amazing thing to read. Because, again, humility is something that a lot of people that I mentioned, Russell Brand, they try and talk about it. He says he struggles with that a lot because he's inherently a narcissist. Yeah. Who is the magician? He's an illusionist, Darren Brown. He's written a book as well. And he's a big advocate for humility as well. And he says his version of humility is about letting go and being comfortable with, I'm not sure where I'm going, but that's okay kind of thing. Because also with control, you have maybe the opposite of humility, maybe arrogance. Right. I want to control the situation. But yeah. And as a writer, as an author, that must be a special feeling as well. what's your take in the book? Is there anything that you want to talk about?
Well, basically, my take is, again, it's centered on my faith. So there's a cultural understanding of humility, which is that a humble person is someone who keeps in the shadows, is very bent over, who lets people walk all over them. And obviously that's not something that any of us aspire to be, or at least very few. But then there's what I call a biblical understanding of humility, which is there's a God out there that actually loves us and has promised to take care of us. And all he's asking us to do is let him. That's his whole story. And if we can actually say, okay, I trust that that's true, and I trust that I can't offer anything to this creator being, and then I'm able to sit back and say, well, actually, that makes me equal to everyone else. And I don't need to compete with those people. I don't need to prove myself better than any of those people. I can actually just say, look, I'm fine. I've got what I need. What do you need? What can I help you with? And then that then leads you to serve other people, which I believe is ultimately our calling as people, is to serve other people.
And this is a nice segue as well into serve the city.
Exactly.
And that's where the name comes from, right? Because the name strikes me because, you have Concern or Oxfam or Amnesty or charities that have different names, but serve the city grabs your attention because it is something that has an inherent meaning in the name. And you've described, more or less, the idea behind the name. Can you just describe for our listeners some of the things you've been doing?
Yeah.
And also the problem that you've encountered now.
Right.
And how you're looking to overcome this particular problem as well. Yeah.
So Serve the City as an organization actually started in Belgium in 2005, I think it was. And it was started by a guy who wanted to go out in the community and work for a local charity and do some hours volunteering. Unfortunately, it was really difficult to get in there. They wouldn't let people in to volunteer. So they ended up making an agreement with this charity that said, look, we will come every week, okay, as an organization, but we'll bring different people. But we'll be there every week, like the work that you need doing every week, we will do it. But I can't guarantee it's going to be the same people to do it. Well, this idea took off really, really quickly. And before long, they were doing it in various different charities in Brussels. And I don't know if the listeners have been to Brussels, but it's a very, very international city and people come and go from there all the time. And so people were leaving and they were saying, hey, can I do this in my city? And Carlton Deal, the chap that started it, said, well, I don't know, can you? and he just let people go off and do it. There was no central organization, there's nothing like that. And so it spread all over, and it's now in about 60 or 70 different cities around the world. And my wife and I experienced this once in 2007. They had a week here of activities, and we just loved it. We just thought, what a great way to, rather than say, hey, I'm the expert in homelessness, or I'm the expert in this or that, wouldn't it be great to just go alongside the people who are the experts and say, how can we serve you? What do we need? What do you need? And how can we help you fulfill your dreams? So 2007 rolled by, and we thought someone should really start that here in Madrid. And 2008 rolled by, and that person still hadn't turned up. 2009, 2010, 2011. And eventually my wife and I said, well, why don't we go to the international conference that they have? Just hear about it. You know, maybe there are people that, you know, we can drag into it. So off we went, and by the end of the weekend, we just said, okay, we have to try. We have to see if we can do this in Madrid. So we came back, and in 2012, we held our first project day, which was an incredible struggle, because when you call a charity in Spain and say, hey, can we come along and do anything you want us to do? The immediate reaction is, what is this? Is this a trick?
Yeah.
No. We don't want you people coming. And especially as we were foreigners as well, they were like, who are you guys? But eventually we found projects, and we held an evening of just saying to our friends, look, if you'd like to come and volunteer, we're going to be at the pub on Friday. Come down and let's have a chat. Well, about 70 people turned up that first night, and we were like, oh, this is not quite what we were expecting. So on our first project day, we did about 20 projects. We had like 150 volunteers, and we did everything from building a house to picking up rubbish to working with kids that are immigrants. It was just a really special day. So everything we did with Serve the City was for someone else. We didn't do anything of our own, because we don't know anything, but we just know people that can help. And because of my professional background, what I hoped I could bring was a little bit of the corporate mindset into those nonprofits. So we wanted to train them, you know, how to do social media, how to do, make film production, how to do graphic design properly, so that they could reach a wider audience. And so we started doing more and more projects, and in the end, 2016, 17, 18, we were doing between 10 and 20,000 volunteer hours each year. We did about 200 to 300 projects a year, and we were working for about 45 different charities in various ways, some every week, some once a month. And so we built up a really great network, and it was fantastic. One of the problems that we encountered here is that raising funds for charities is really difficult. It's a permanent struggle. Especially here in Spain, because of the crisis in 2008, the government cut a lot of the funding to charities. About 75%, in fact, of the funding was cut. And so that meant that we had to think of different ways. How do you raise funds for that? Because although we're a volunteer organization, to host and pay for 300 events a year is really expensive. And so we ended up having to be a little bit entrepreneurial with how we approached our funding. And so we said, okay, we're a charity, but we're going to raise money like a company. And then we're going to use all of that money to put back into the community. We're not going to take anything out. It all goes right back in. And so we had a few different funding streams. One was doing corporate social responsibility projects with companies who want their employees to go volunteering. A second was voluntourism. So we invited people to come over from all over the world. We had a big chalet where they could stay, and they would go out volunteering for a charity every day for weeks or months at a time. And then the third is donations. Donations was a disaster, always was. And I think that's partly cultural, and partly our failing, you know, just because we didn't fully tap into how that works here, and so we never really mastered that. The voluntourism, which is the people coming over from other countries, ended up being the vast majority of our income. About 85% actually of our income came from that. And then the other 10-15% came from the CSR, corporate social responsibility. And so things went okay, you know, for a few years, but then we started to have problems with the organization that we'd partnered with that was sending us the volunteers. because we realized that they were just a company. They weren't interested in volunteering. They were just interested in people paying a commission to come over here. And so they started to send more and more people who had no intention of volunteering. They just wanted to go on holiday, and it was cheap to do it through us. And so that caused us unbelievable stress and tension. Until eventually at the end of last year, you know, we'd had enough disagreements with them that they decided to work with another partner. And so we said, well, you can't supply us both. And we had to make a very difficult decision to end our relationship with them, which unfortunately meant that we lost 85% of our funding, which also meant that we had to let go of all of our staff. It still is a very big crisis for us, because this is one of those things where you have to choose the values of the organization over the funding of the organization. It's not a nice position to be in, but at a certain point you have to say, look, we don't exist just to exist. We exist to do good, and we exist to help others. And if we're putting in so much energy to raise this revenue just to keep existing, we've kind of missed the point. The December this happened last year, and it was just a terrible few weeks. Had to let go of all the staff. Their last day was Christmas Eve, so they loved me, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And we're still dealing with the side effects of that. The government here are not particularly friendly to nonprofits, and they've been chasing us for taxes now since the beginning of February. And it's literally bankrupted my wife and I again. I can sit here and cry about it, and it has been very, very tough. But at the end of the day, you know, life's like that sometimes. It isn't plain sailing, and people have this idea from social media probably that your life is a constant upward slope, and that you've reached this pinnacle and it just gets better and better. But certainly my experience is not like that. It's more like a wave. There are seasons where everything's great, and then there are seasons where things are bad. For me, the important thing is to learn from those tough times and say, okay, I don't mind making mistakes. I think actually mistakes are really useful. I think what's important is that we don't repeat those mistakes.
It's an incredible story. First of all, it takes a lot of conviction and initiative to get these things off the ground, which you and your wife displayed immensely. I think we're both very disappointed to hear the government are chasing for taxes, because this was a socialist government that's doing that. Because we did an interview with a guy as well who in Seoul, he dresses as Charlie Chaplin, and he was telling me as well that all the street performers are also being hassled by the police as well. So personally, we both think it's a disgrace as well that a nominally socialist government is so unfriendly towards people who are either in the third sector or on the streets.
You may not know that they're actually the police now actually fine homeless people for being on the street.
It's it beggars belief, because even we have another interview lined up. There's a priest in La Latina, which you can explain a little bit more about as well.
Yes, you probably know him, Padre Ángel.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah. He's quite an authority.
He's wonderful.
He's done so much, so obviously he's always really busy.
Yeah.
But we're really hoping to speak to him, because... but even with that, there's a bit of an issue between him and the neighbors and between him and the authorities, so... It's all complicated, but I was thinking about that when you were explaining about the corporate idea, because I think despite being a priest, he's been using that quite cleverly.
Yes.
Because, for example, I don't know, with Florentino Fernandez from Real Madrid, or I don't know, there are people that when you were explaining about the corporate responsibility, I'm not saying, you know, because he's doing that, like... that erases everything else that he does, especially to do with property and all this is an issue. But I think he's been clearly getting some very high-profile people to get involved in things.
Yeah.
But then, I don't know, I think we were going to come to that a little bit later, that it has to be an association between these people that want to help and can have an influence, but also society and the authorities. So it's kind of like this balance that we're interested in.
Because like when we've been researching this, we've seen a lot of people advocating what you've advocated, which is that NGOs need to have a more corporate mentality. While we can see the benefits of that, we're not entirely convinced by that, to be fair, but we're very interested to hear your thoughts on that in more detail, and we'll put specific questions as well. But before that, you've mentioned the priest and the local, the neighborhood basically being anti his initiatives for homeless people. In America, for example, volunteerism is also down, because basically millennials don't really volunteer. And we've been talking about the socialist government as well, who've been adopted a tough stance against NGOs, for example. So, I mean, a lot of people out there who are not helpful in terms of the things you want to achieve. What keeps you motoring? What keeps you fighting, you know, with that?
I think stubbornness. No, I think it's important to realize that these people who are doing things that are against what you're doing, whatever it is you're doing, they're not sat up in a room going, oh, I'm going to destroy the third sector.
No, that's fair enough. But like millennials, for example, they're picked on a lot, I guess. But like they don't volunteer. Also, you have people like in that neighborhood in La Latina. And it really like personally frustrates me because it's nobody wants. I mean, I wouldn't want to see a huge homeless crisis in my neighborhood because it makes you uncomfortable. It makes going to the shop a different experience. But the thing is, you can't move the problem somewhere else. It's like the refugee crisis as well. European governments paying Libya to stop immigrants from coming from Africa getting to Europe. It's just like out of sight, out of mind. This is a problem and it has to be fixed. And by a problem, I mean there's people who need help, not because it's a problem of seeing people on the street that might cause you some personal feeling of insecurity. When I say a problem, I don't mean that. I mean there's people...
It is a problem. I'm with you,
And real people who need help. Like, so, I mean, so of course, I'm not like objectively thinking, how will I ruin this guy's day? Or how will I hurt the NGO sector? But they're still adopting these policies that are really unhelpful and like selfish as well, you know?
Yes, I mean, it is a challenge. In 2013, we actually went and sat with the government to talk about a project that we wanted to run here, which was called a community dinner, where we invite the homeless, the elderly, the drug addicts, the prostitutes, the pimps, everyone to sit at the table together and just be served like they're in a restaurant. And we run this in Surf City in Portugal, and it's had a dramatic effect.
Yeah.
Well, we asked the government here, this was back when it was PP, and after like 4 minutes, the guy who was the head of social services in Spain at the time said, look, we will never let you do that here, ever.
Take it.
And we were like, perhaps we've not explained it well. He goes, no, what you don't understand is that all you non-profits do is fill people's heads with dreams that you can't fulfill.
It's so
we
stupid.
As a government are providing them with everything they need.
Yeah, a PP government as well, yeah.
And we were with them for an hour trying to explain, look, we're not here to cause any harm. Our job is to serve the city. If you can tell us a better way that we can do that, we'll do it.
That's the thing, because you've explained your modus operandi, and it's so perfect. It's, you know, we really dig it. You know, it's you collaborate with people, and you're open-minded. And I just don't understand, the biggest barrier to having a safer and more equal society is exclusion. And if people don't have a stake in society, they're not going to feel any need to contribute to that society. And if you and that dinner in Portugal is going to give that those kind of people a feeling of inclusion and a stake in society. And I don't understand how, you know, nominally educated people like politicians who are running the government don't see what is common sense. You know, you have to make people feel involved.
Well, this is a topic that you can also cover with Padre Angel, because he managed to do it.
Okay.
He managed to do the dinner. Behind the post office in Madrid, there's the big glass conservatory area, and one New Year's Eve, I think it was, he had a couple of hundred people in there, but it was only the homeless. And we've stayed away from doing that a little bit because we feel that's still exclusion.
Yeah.
You know, come you weird people and have a dinner on your own. We do like to do things where we have volunteers come and sit with them, and we say to them, listen, tonight you're not allowed to offer them any help. Don't tell them you can fix them. Just get to know them.
Yeah.
Just ask them who they are. Tell them your story. and treat them like they're just regular people, because they are.
Well, that's the thing, because my uncle actually does a lot of work with homeless people in Ireland, and if he heard this, he would kill me because he doesn't like any any attention. But like, his approach has always been that he chats to them, he breaks their chops, you know, right. Like, he just talks to them like he would to anybody.
Yep.
And he says the reaction he gets from them is incredible, because there's people who could be in a wheelchair, and there's people who are dancing around them, oh, do you want this, and obviously trying to help them, but it makes the person on the receiving end of that feel less than or an other.
Right.
And if you just talk to them normally as you described, mm-hmm. they really do react to that in a very positive way, you know. I have a friend in Holland who's organized a dinner you mentioned for refugees. It's a double initiative using food from supermarkets that have been thrown out, so to stop food waste, but also help refugees as well feel that inclusion, because volunteers and refugees can eat together. He's run into a small problem though, because it's kind of funny in a way, because there's always these unforeseen issues. So the refugees at the start didn't fully understand that the second part of the NGO was to stop food waste. And they thought, well, we're getting second-rate food here, which in reality wasn't the case. But so that took a while to negotiate or navigate, but I think it's all good now, don't you?
Right.
So yeah, I'm sure you've had plenty of experiences like that as well.
Yeah, I mean, the third sector is full of very entrepreneurial people, because the normal, like, the world is set up for businesses, you know?
Yeah.
If you're in the third sector, the normal rules don't apply to you. Like, to give you a silly example, we have to pay VAT as a charity.
Okay.
And we can't claim that VAT back, whereas a company can. So it's actually more expensive to be a charity than it is to be a company. So this is one of the problems that we're having with the government now, because back in 2017, we had this apartment, and we, part of your rent, although you don't see it in the receipts you might get as an individual, is for EVA. And our historic at the time came to us and said, you are not meant to be paying EVA because this is volunteer housing. So we were like, well, I don't know, talk to the landlord. So, you know, they spoke to the landlord, and the landlord was like, oh yeah, you're right. He gave us back the EVA, and then we didn't ever pay it again. Well, then this year, at the beginning of this year, in February this year, the government contacted and said, you owe EVA for all these years on that house. And we were like, what are you talking about? We have never had a discussion with anyone. A store told us that they dealt with it. And so it's about €30,000. And wonderfully here, a store is not liable for the advice that they give you. And it turns out the law changed about a month after that conversation. And there's no way out of that. So my wife and I will have to foot that bill. We don't have that money. But, you know... fortunately, we're in a place where we have a very loose hold on money anyway, in the sense that it's not that we have any money, because we don't, but we're not so worried about that number on that screen that's in some bank account.
You're emotionally free from...
Yeah, we've a long time now, we've been living in an environment where we would like to have money. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a Buddhist monk who wants to live on a hill. But it's not the source of my happiness. It's not the source of my contentment for my future. So I don't know how we're going to get it, but we will.
Okay.
You know, that's how life works. It might take us years, but we will get it. And you just keep going.
Well, don't go into English teaching.
No, I've heard that.
So some very interesting things there. Is there a few questions you'd like to ask as well, Maria?
Well... No, and I'm just curious from the perspective of a native, you know, a Spanish person, because you explained at the beginning how it worked and how you decided to do this like Spanish branch of Serve the City. And from what I understood reading about you, it felt more like some sort of hub, like that aimed to help all the charities, but not be the charity in itself.
Yes.
And I suppose... To me, it was something that I had never come across before in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering whether part of it is due to the fact that, you know, like Spanish people have never come across this.
Yeah.
But also, I was wondering as well, and this is a bit of a philosophical question, I guess, because I've wondered about this many times. You know, you see so many charities and so many charities contact you. And then you sort of feel like, well, especially in a place like Spain, where you get taxed so much and there's no real official help, then what is the point of like having more and more charities,
right,
you know, that are doing very similar things? And I have always felt, of course, I'm not talking about your case in particular, but about the case of individual charities, I have always felt that, I don't know, there's like a very like egotistic element to it where everybody wants to be the one that is helping. So the entrepreneurial part of it is very cool in a sense, but I think there's also the danger of like, especially when you come from another country, and I'm saying this from the point of view of somebody who's lived, I've lived in the UK for 8 years.
Well, I'm sorry.
So, I know. Well, life is not perfect. But,
it was Newcastle as well.
8 years of not understanding anything.
But by the end, you end up having the talk as well, which you can probably.
Sound like Anton Deck when she came
You can
back.
Probably hear. Okay, but no, but what I was trying to get at is that. When you go to another country, you kind of like somehow feel the perhaps the extra need to bring something into it. I don't know whether it's out of guilt because you feel you have to contribute, or whether it's there's a patronizing element perhaps to it of like, I need to like teach these people, you know, things. I don't know how you feel about all that. It's a lot of like criticism, but it comes like it,
no,
it's
I,
more
I,
my critical approach to
I've,
it.
I've,
you know
it's,
what I mean?
It's not the first time I've heard these things, so I'm not surprised to hear it. I think a bit of context is important. Obviously, from the UK, normally about 40% of the population volunteer in the UK. So I've come from that background where volunteering is really normal. Spain has the third lowest rate of volunteering in all of Europe. And when I initially tell people that, they're like, oh, that's terrible, the Spanish are this, the Spanish are that. But again, it's context. The reason that the rate of volunteering here is so low is because the family here is so strong. And if there is any problem with anyone in my extended family, I will go off and I will do that. And we, as a family, will gather around that person and we'll look after them. Now, that doesn't happen in the UK, you know. If it's my cousin and, you know, whatever, oh, you're on your own, off you go. And so that strong family element here is one of the real contributing factors why volunteering is much lower.
That's interesting.
Well, but the thing is, in Ireland, I'm sure that's a very strong case for Spain. In Ireland, the family, I think, would traditionally also be a very strong element. And I haven't seen any figures, but being Irish, from what I've gathered and having been a volunteer myself in Ireland, I imagine that there is a high rate of volunteerism, but also the family element is quite strong in Ireland as well. So you had that twin thing as well.
Like I say, every culture is different. And so when we came here, we didn't do this for the first 15 years, or, well, not quite, for the first 11 or something years that we were here. But I think maybe when you do come in as a foreigner, you're more aware of the issues, because when you're a local, you've grown up with it, and that's the background noise. Whereas a foreigner going into another environment, or even to another city, you just notice things that aren't what they're like back home, you know, and you see those things and you think, gosh, I could probably help out there a little bit. However, having given that defense, I agree with you that there are too many charities doing the same thing. And so that was one of the big things that we strived for as an organization, was to draw all these charities together and say, hey, you work with the homeless, so do they. Why don't you pool resources? Why do you have a van and they have a van and you both have an office? Why don't we get you together? And so what we did, we spent a lot of time doing network events just for the charities. No volunteers there. We just got the charities together and said, why don't you work together? And then finally, one of the last initiatives that we launched was something called re-volunteering, where we went to those associations that were perhaps working with the elderly or the homeless or whatever and said, look, we're not going to volunteer for you anymore. We want your people to volunteer for someone else. And so we'd take the elderly and we'd do a sandwich route with them and give out home to the stuff to the poor, or, you know, come and play with the immigrant children or whatever it would be, to say you have something to give as well as a need that needs to be met. So yeah, I hope I responded.
Yes, definitely. To be honest, it was more, you know, I was playing devil's advocate a bit, because there are there are questions that I thought of, and but well, you said some things that I hadn't considered. So
Good.
We had time to fill, so we have to get long answers. Is that for example, a three common complaints from volunteers or people who don't volunteer? So they don't have any time, mm-hmm. and there's no interesting roles for them, and nobody told them about it. So that's the last point, is probably a question of social media. Yeah. No time, I think, is self-explanatory as well. No interesting roles kind of grab my attention. Mm. I get that people are searching for meaning. You described that as well at the beginning of our conversation. But do you think if you have a drive to be a volunteer that you have the right to choose what's personally meaningful for you? Or should you just get on with it and go, well, this isn't my bag really, but okay, I'll volunteer for it, you know?
I think there's two elements to that. I think it's really important to recognize that if you're volunteering, you're helping someone else. And so you've got to be conscious of what help do they actually need, you know? The other element is, well, I've got certain gifts and talents and skills, and I'd really like to put those things to work. You know, I'd like to find a way to do that. And this is one of the other initiatives that I've started, is an app called Velping, which enables a volunteer to basically create their own motivation through gamification, which is a whole nother podcast. But gamification are the tricks that companies use to get you to do the tasks that they want you to do. So when you go into Facebook and there's that little red dot on the message thing that makes you click on it,
okay.
That's gamification. And this application enables a user to put in their skills and their passions, and then it will match them with a charity in their city that is looking for someone with those skills and passions. And it's still in development, so you can't go and play with it, so don't. But you can go and look at it on velping.com.
Sounds great.
Yeah, and the idea of that application is exactly what you're saying, is to say, right, how do I get the people with the right talents in the right place? Because Stanford have done a study on this, and the EU did a study on this, and they found that the drop-off rate for volunteers is massive.
That is true.
Because they're not being matched with a suitable project, and once they've done the project, they don't feel that it made any difference. There's no way to look at it and go, did that make a difference? Because I only did 2 hours.
Yeah.
And so that can be very demotivating. So what we were trying to do with the app was say, well, no, we want you to know that the 2 hours you did 2 years ago still matters.
Yeah.
We developed a way to graphically demonstrate that to people.
No, it sounds genuinely fantastic. I guess from our perspective as well, because we do a lot of things, but also ESL teaching, we feel the burden to, you know, make the lesson fun for the student.
Right.
And there's always a part of you that thinks like, well, come on, you're 40, you're here to learn, just learn the damn thing, you know? And I think there's a little bit of me that thinks as well, you want to volunteer, so just pull up your socks and volunteer. But no, what you said is very interesting. I do agree with a lot of it as well. The last question I want to ask you before we finish, because we're running out of time. Dan Pelota and...
brilliant.
You love that guy.
Absolutely brilliant.
I should have asked you this sooner than earlier in the podcast. And also Melinda Gates. I'm assuming you've seen his TED Talk then. So the question I want to ask you is, he thinks... you probably agree with this, I imagine, that people in the charity sector should be financially motivated and incentivized in the same way that people in industries are. And also that we have a screwed up moral compass, in a sense, because we don't think anything of companies that are not in the charity sector, who are financially motivated, but don't have any stake in helping society. But we look poorly on NGOs that are financially motivated and obviously have a stake in helping people, that we have mixed up values with that. Do you agree with him? Do you disagree with him? Or
I mean, 100%.
Yeah.
I think, as Dan Pelota says in his talk, the way you think about charity is all wrong, by the way, if you've not seen it. You know, there are huge cultural and social issues that we're facing. But as soon as somebody makes any kind of good salary doing charity work, we think they are the worst person in the world.
Yeah.
However, if a CEO of a company is making, you know, $150 million a year and using slave labor and, you know, abusing people and selling products at a 50% profit margin,
yeah.
Well, we put them on the front of a magazine, or Man of the Year.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with that. There's something wrong with that. We should say to them, look at the lives this individual has changed. Look how many people they've fed. Look at this new thing that they've developed to give clean energy to people in Africa or wherever it might be. They should get 100 million a year because they're doing something so amazing. That's what should have real value to us.
I can see where he's coming from with that. I just find, and neither of us are economists, we don't have a financial background, but I find that sometimes people who do have a financial background talk about the economy or business almost in a mystical, semi-religious aspect. I'm not saying that because you've come here, as you mentioned your faith. There's a great book about this kind of, I can't even really describe it, but it's this belief that's kind of been through human civilization from the start of religion, but then going on into the economy, even sports, all these different things, where people have this almost fundamentalist belief in something. And when it comes to the economics, you can point to Reaganism, Thatcherism, nothing to do with our conversation today, but they would be examples of people who almost religiously believe in the economy. And what I want to say is, I think the trap that sometimes we fall into is like, if X and Y are there, we'll automatically get said. And that's led to two financial crises, I think. And I just think that even though Dan Pilota obviously is very capable, Melinda Gates is very capable, doing a lot for charity as well, very successful people, I'm not knocking them, that maybe it's just a little bit too simplistic, because when it comes to the economy, it's not rational, and companies are not rational entities. And applying those things to the third sector, I don't think it's going to produce the rainbows and butterflies that they think it's going to produce. And I think people, you know, obviously have NGO fatigue, but even more, I think we have a corporate fatigue as well. And even marrying those two things, I think that there's obviously a lot of benefits to it. Again, I'm not knocking it, but I wouldn't be completely sold on it personally myself, you know?
No, and that's fine. This is something that I think is going to take many, many years for there to be any kind of cultural shift, if there's ever going to be a cultural shift.
Yeah.
But I think Dan Pilota summed it up best in that if you want the best people, you've got to reward them for it.
Yeah, he mentioned that in a talk, and I was thinking, if you are charitably minded, you want to do that. I mean, look at your case. You had to choose between keeping on your staff or following your principles and these hard decisions, and you stuck with your principles. So I imagine, and that's a great credit to you. It's truly, really brave and wonderful decision that you can stick to your principles like that. And I imagine that a lot of people who are in the NGO sector would be motivated by a sense of principle as well, and that maybe the financial question isn't as important for them, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, and I would say of the 45 charities that we work with in Madrid, there is only one charity where I question the integrity of the people that are working there.
Okay, spill the beans.
Yeah. But the other 44, I'm almost convinced that a lot of them are actually angels.
Yeah.
Because the sacrifices they make for these people, it breaks your heart to see it. They've given up their entire lives for it, their entire lives. And so it is wonderful that that's their passion. But it would be great to live in a society where that was also recognized as having value.
Okay.
And that they could, I would love to see those people be rewarded for that in some way.
Okay, it's a very nice way to end the podcast. Warren, you're doing great work in Madrid. You've been a wonderful person to talk to. So thank you so much again for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Do you want to say thank you as well?
Yay, gracias.
So you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Patreon, and find us on our blog as well, Irish Slice of Madrid. And we'll be back with you again for the next episode.